Question number 16716. Canon Gervais Markham, reel 2.
Canon Markham, reel 2. You were talking about the OTC at the college. How much time in a week would you spend?
We had one parade a week, I suppose. And for this, we had to dress up in uniform. We had to know how to polish our boots, which was a very specialized art. We had to know how to wind our putties, which was equally difficult to make them stay up. We had khaki uniform without collar and tie, dressed as privates, of course, and we had rifles, and we did arms drill, we did platoon drill, and once in the summer term we had to go out on an OTC operation, expedition, what was the name? What the word for it was, but you would go out and have a mock battle somewhere on the downs with other OTC, and then for a week in the summer you would have an OTC camp at Tweedledown or a big I'm sure we spent a week under canvas and were properly drilled, and it was rather exciting. We enjoyed doing it. That was my military background when I was a boy.
Was it expected for all boys to take part in this?
Oh, yes, yes, it was. Later on, there came the choice. If you were between the wars, you could opt to do service, what is it, social service or something instead. Oh, indeed, the scouts, you would be a scout instead. But it was odd. I can't remember anybody really wanting to opt out of the OTC. It was just one of the things that you did, and you accepted this as part of life.
Who were training you?
Well, there were masters on the staff who had, of course, served in the First World War and been in the army, and we were closely allied with the Rifle Brigade at Winchester, and so they had their officers came. So we always marched away to Colonel Bogey whenever we went anywhere. That's my contact with the rifle regiment, not, of course, with the Dalton Light Infantry.
Yeah. What happened to you after you left Winchester?
I went to Cambridge, Trinity College, Cambridge, where my father had been. You asked what examination I was working for. Well, I don't remember taking any particular examination to get into Cambridge. It's curious looking back on it. They said, well, I don't think you're good enough to get a scholarship. It's not worthwhile doing that. On the other hand, somebody must have said, well, he's in the top form at Winchester, he'll do. So I just went up to Cambridge like that without ever having been there before or having been accepted by anybody. And I read classics for first part of my tripos, because it was the only thing I knew. But after I'd done my first part, they said, well, you're not really very good at Latin or Greek elegiacs. Why not try something else for your second part? And so I said, decided on English. So in the second part of my tripos, I did English, which, and it was a marvelous combination, which I've thoroughly enjoyed, and been part of my formative influence. This combination of classics and English is part of an English education.
Were you already set on entering the church?
No,
at this point?
Certainly not. I remember several occasions deciding that was one thing I was not going to do, because my father and my grandfather had both been clergymen. So I thought it was time I did something else. No, I didn't read theology. I went to Cottage Chapel. I kept up the practice of going to church on Sundays. say my prayers and that sort of thing, but I didn't want to be a clergyman. But so happened when, in my third year, the chaplain of Trinity, who was a great friend of mine, said, "What are you going to do when you go down?" I said, "I have no idea." And he said, "Would you like to go and teach in Jerusalem for a couple of years?" And I said, "Yes," on the spur of the moment, without ever having thought of it before. So, after Cambridge, I spent 2 years in a school in Jerusalem teaching Arab boys in an English medium school run by the Church Missionary Society. Wonderful school, right on the walls of old Jerusalem. And this 2 years in Jerusalem, in the Middle East, was again a very formative part of my background. Wonderful experience of seeing the world and seeing this place, which is the epitome, the center of all different sorts of religions and civilizations, all combining there. It all is centered in Jerusalem. And I was at home there for 2 years.
Were there any pressures in Jerusalem at that time that you see today, for example, the various...
Yes, always have been in Jerusalem. It's the most contentious place. I know it means the city of peace, but it has always been, all through history, it's been the focus of strife, bitterness, bloodshed, competition and rivalry. Inevitably, because peoples of the Middle East take their religion seriously, just as we take football seriously here. So everything is tense. The atmosphere of Jerusalem is always tense, wondering what's going to happen next. This at this particular time when I was there, it was, of course, this was the early 1930s. It was before the big the Hitler episode was just beginning, but the Jews were being leaving Europe and were trying to get there. There had been the Balfour Declaration, which had allowed the Jews to make a national home in Palestine, provided that it didn't interfere with the rights of the existing population. But in fact, they were coming in, and when I was there, the Arabs were saying, "Keep those Jews out," and the Jews were saying, we had in fact mostly Arab boys in the school, but a few Jewish boys as well. We weren't able to live together in those days, but there was tension between the two. But, in fact, there were riots from time to time. For two or three days, I remember, there was such a riot that I and another young Englishman at school, we were called up into the police, we were given uniform and rifles, and was lying out on a hillside waiting for people to come one day. Then after two or three days, the head of the school said, "I really don't think that you ought to go on doing that. You're really trying to shoot the parents of my boys here." So I stopped being a policeman after that. There was that tension all the time.
Mm-hmm. You say this was the early 1930s?
I was there 32 to 34. Yeah.
Hitler was coming to power at that time. Yeah. Were there any signs or indications of the problems that were in Germany?
Oh, yes, that was just beginning. Right from the beginning of Hitler, it was very much anti-Jewish. I spent a month with a Jewish family. I spent a month with a German family in the early 1930s on an exchange. And you could see there all the Jewish signs, the newspapers, the anti-Jewish hatred that was going on, and terrorism was just beginning. And you could see that, of course, they were being shipped out to the... they were trying to escape from Hitler's Germany into Palestine.
Mm-hmm. Within the time itself, was there a distrust of Germans and Germany after the First World War and before the Second?
I don't think I can have any personal experience of that that's worth recounting. The feeling among people, I'm now talking of the late 20s, when I was just growing up, we were trying for reconciliation with Germans. There was an Anglo-German bureau, I remember. We had a German girl to stay with us and our family for a month, and then I went and stayed with their family for a month. This was not only to enable us to learn each other's language, it was to foster relationships between the two countries. Mm. Living in Germany with that particular family, they were an aristocratic family, there was no feeling of hostility because of the First World War. I didn't notice that.
What happened to you after the Jerusalem episode?
Oh, then I went back to Cambridge, and by that time I'd booked a course at Westcott House, a theological college. I suppose the experience of being in Jerusalem for 2 years, and with, of course, this intense interest in the background of the Bible, Bible lands and so on, that had encouraged me to say, oh, well, I think there's a possibility that I might be ordained. And I went to Westcott House in Cambridge, the theological college, for a couple of years, and began to... that was my vocation to the ministry of the church. I had decided by that time that I wanted to be ordained. But that was the first time that I'd taken my religion seriously, as it were, though, of course, in Jerusalem, I'd had to teach RE to Arab boys, many of them Muslim boys, and this was very... I realized how very little I knew about my own religion when Muslim boys started asking me probing questions about what I believed as a Christian. And then I had to defend myself then. But at Westcott House, then I learned the sort of basics of Christian theology.
How long was that course of study?
That was a 2-year course, Cambridge ordination course. And then I suppose this is where we began to tie in with Durham, because at the end of my second year, the principal said, well, where are you going to go as a curate? And I said, well, I don't know. I haven't got as far as that yet. He said, oh, well, I suggest two places, one in Manchester. There's a very good... What you need is a good rector who will train you as a curate. There's a good man in Manchester. I went to see him, and also Vicar of Sunderland, Bishop Weymouth in Sunderland. You go there. So I went to spend a weekend with the R.W. Stannard, the rector of Bishop Weymouth in Sunderland, and I decided if he would have me, that would be a very good place to go and learn my the basics of being a clergyman. But I hadn't seen the bishop. Looking back on it now, it's extraordinary. Sort of haphazard, casual the thing was done. It was only about 6 weeks, I think, before time for ordination, and I then had to go and see Bishop Hensley Henson. Are we wanting a time? I had to get permission to be, or see if he would prepare to ordain me. This was rather surprising for him, because normally he picked his ordination candidates a year or two beforehand, and here was a man turning up 6 weeks' notice saying, may I be ordained? So I had the formidable experience of going to stay at Auckland Castle and being interviewed by the famous Bishop Hensley Henson. This was a fascinating weekend, as you can imagine. And however, at the end of it, he said, yes, certainly I'm willing to ordain you, and you can go and be a curate at Bishop Weymouth. So I was duly ordained in Durham Cathedral, which was a very moving experience, of course, and set my stall up in Sunderland as one of three curates at Bishop Weymouth Parish Church.
Mm-hmm. What age were you now?
Well, that was in 1936, so I was 26 by the time. Yeah. Mm.
Had you any experience of Durham people at all?
Not at all, no. This was, of course, a complete eye-opener. Living in Sunderland, I had never been in the north before. I'd never lived in an industrial town. My education had been what you would now call a very sheltered one. I had always lived either school, college, university, or abroad. I had lived in the educational world. I had never really mixed with ordinary industrial population at all. But I found it fascinating. Bishop Wearmouth Church had recently been rebuilt. It was a very fine, beautiful building, and the church was the center of life in that town, in a way which I suppose it cannot be in these days. But I was one of three curates. I was given a quarter of the parish to do my house-to-house visiting in. And so in the afternoon, I would go out to one of these little back streets and knock at the door and see what happened. I didn't know quite what I was supposed to do. I was just learning my trade, as it were, that this was the thing that had to be done. You do house-to-house visiting in that particular quarter of the parish. Well, this was in the days, of course, in the Great Depression, in the shipbuilding and in the mining industries in the middle of the 1930s. A great many people were unemployed. There was great poverty. And I learnt to detect at once, when I went into a tenement or house, whether the man was unemployed by the smell. I used to keep a certain rather shiny Macintosh, which I wore on these occasions, because I didn't like sitting down on the chairs. There was a smell in these poor little homes, which I've never experienced again, which I could remember for years afterwards. The poverty of the home, with newspaper on the table, with old, you were offered a mug of tea, which you had to drink. But I discovered afterwards the smell was a mixture of lice and urine. you could notice it as you went into these houses. On the other hand, they were all very friendly, very welcoming to me. The man would always say, "Oh, yes, I believe in one above." And he would send his kids to Sunday school. And he would go to the church regularly on watch night to see the New Year in, even though he was half seas over at the time. It was a regular practice that you went to the watch night service. And one of my duties, I remember, on the Saturday evening was to be, we had a big church hall where we showed pictures, movies, usually Charlie Chaplin, and the kids of the neighborhood were all keen to get in there. You paid tuppence. I had to stand at the door and take tuppence from every kid. Scores of them were rushing in, and there must have been hundreds, I suppose, filling this great hall. And when the movie started, Charlie Chaplin film was a great moment of the week. And this is what the church did for the people in those days. And there were many other things, of course, I learned how.
What other duties and responsibilities did you have as a curate?
As a curate? Well, I did a lot of funerals. I did hospital visiting. It was part of my duties to learn how to do that. I remember my first funeral that I conducted. I realized I'd never been at the graveside before. None of my immediate family had ever died. But the first time I actually stood at the graveside, it was on a very snowy day, and it was a little child that was being buried. I had to take, say, the words for this, and I didn't really know whether I was doing it properly or not, but it was a very moving experience to have to do it. And
did the poverty shock you at first?
Well, it was very shocking. Well, it was. I'd heard about it, but finding it actually there was very striking. I don't remember being shocked as such. Shocking is a difficult word to express, but I was involved in it, and going round to these little houses where so many people were unemployed, I was very sorry for them, but there was very little one could do about it. There were various unemployed men's clubs. I used to try and fraternize with people in those, but I wasn't one to wave banners and try and change the whole social structure. I was dealing with individual people, learning how to do them, how to treat them.
It must have been a widening experience for yourself.
Oh, yes.
Into this situation.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure it helped me to grow up a lot. I'm a very callow youth, I'm sure, from this strangely different, maybe sheltered background. I'd seen life in many different ways. I'd been abroad for a couple of years, but I'd never been involved in this particular class of life before.
What hours would a curate work? What were your daily hours? Or were there
you
such
didn't
things
have
as daily
hours? You worked all day. You didn't count hours. You didn't count pay. No doubt you turned up at the parish church, probably morning prayer at 7 o'clock every morning, Holy Communion, and you'd go for breakfast, and you'd go to one of the church schools. You'd be either taking the assembly or taking a class in RE. You would then go back to the rest of the morning. You would be trying to do your theological study. You would be preparing sermons or classes. You then have lunch in the afternoon. You would out visiting. And in the evening, there would be men's clubs, boys' clubs, scouts, guides, all the different church organizations that you were involved in. Committee meeting, and if you got back, I suppose, 9:30 or so, that would be the end of the day. But you didn't really count the hours as people do, or on a fixed time. And I never have all my life.
Did you consider that at that time? Was it a hard life?
It was the life that I was prepared for. Of course, it was hard. That's why I went to the north instead of going into some country village in the south. Yeah. It was curiously enough, only this morning I'd just been reading the biography, the obituary in the Times of man Forbes Horn, a clergyman who just died, who was very much a contemporary of mine and doing the same sort of thing, the same sort of attitudes when he was young. It's described in the Times today. The young men at theological colleges in those days were mainly from public schools and the universities, and how they all tended to go off to some industrial town in the north to start their ministry as part of the challenge of life.
Yes.
And I was one of them.
Do you recall your first pay, the amount that you were getting?
I don't at all, no. It was enough to live on, but not enough to save. I never have, in the course of my life, been able to earn money so that I could save. But the people with my particular background didn't really go into the ministry in order to... You knew that there would be enough money for you to get by, and that was all you considered. I can't remember what my pay was.
This was coming, of course, up towards the war now.
Yes.
Were there signs that something was brewing?
Yes, I remember in Sunderland. Well, I remember being in the men's club one night when we heard Edward VIII's broadcast, which he abdicated. This was terribly shocking because we had no idea of what was going on with Edward VIII. We all revered him as a splendid, popular young man. We didn't know all the background of his character that we now read about in biographies. We thought of him as the most far-travelled, highly respected, popular young king that we ever had. We were very proud of him. And it came as a bombshell when we learned all this business of Mrs. Simpson and his abdication.
Was the church united as an opponent of the marriage?
Why didn't church wasn't consulted? There was no wasn't debated. We didn't discuss all these things in public. We didn't know anything about it. The Bishop of Bradford, who was always accused of making a speech that provoked it, he had no idea any more than anybody else of what was going on in the background of this. But once it was known that he was trying to marry, or wanting to marry a woman who'd been divorced twice, I remember one man in the working town, "Yeah, she's near better than a pitman's daughter." And it was universal. No, we couldn't possibly tolerate a woman like that to be queen. Mm-hmm. There was no question about it. Yeah. So that it wasn't a matter of the church being united against it. It was just nobody. Once people knew about it, it wasn't considered possible at all.
The war clouds were gathering. Were there any other signs that it was close?
It didn't affect us very much. What do I remember about... Oh, there was the Munich business, 1938. I remember the enormous relief when Chamberlain came back and waving his piece of paper and saying that there was not going to be any war. There was a very... strong movement against us being involved in any war. There was the peace pledge, the peace union at that time. When I remember when it was heard that Chamberlain had come back and there was not going to be a war, the rector opened the parish church and said there will be a service of thanksgiving that night. Of course, people had radios and heard about it. In fact, this big church was people being thankful that there wasn't going to be a war. We weren't bellicose. I wasn't involved in TA or any of these things. We were expecting and wanting this peace to go on. Only the older ones, well, we could remember the First World War, but nobody expected that there would be another one. It became, as far as me and my circle, which was a sort of boat from the blue. Perhaps the people in politics were, perhaps people in the TA were getting ready for it, but I wasn't involved in that at all. I was just in the ordinary, the civilian population of hoping, thinking that our politicians were quite capable of keeping us out of any war that was going on.
Where were you and what were you doing when war was announced?
Ah, well, after I'd been 3 years as a curate in Sunderland, Hensley Henson, the bishop, retired, and a new bishop came, A.T.P. Williams, who in fact had been my headmaster at Winchester. When he came to live at Auckland Castle, this was 1930, early 39, I think, he had to look round for a domestic chaplain. And he asked me if I would be his chaplain, which was like being a private secretary ADC combination. And first I thought, I'm in the front line here doing the curate's job in Sunderland, do I want to go and live in a castle? But he said, this is a job I think you will find that is worthwhile doing. you've had your stint in an industrial parish, come and do this. So I bought a typewriter and spent a fortnight learning how to type, and then went off to Walton Castle and became his private chaplain. This was just as war was beginning to loom, and I was in fact at Auckland Castle listened. Of course, there was no television, but there was a wireless set which was kept in I think it was the butler's room upstairs. I remember the bishop and I going to listen to these early speeches about the war and the declaration of war on the Auckland Castle radio. And I stayed there for the first winter of the war. It was that very snowy winter indeed. And I went round with the bishop during the first months of the war. And I used to bicycling out to take services in some of the pit villages around about Bishop Auckland, till the time came when I thought, really, I can't go on doing this when there was a war on. And I said, I think I ought to go and be an army chaplain.